The Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference, co-sponsored by the Institute for Anarchist Studies and Institute for Social Ecology, aims to provide a space in which to re-examine and reinvigorate the social and political tradition of anarchism. Reflections on the Dispossessed. Some of the most valuable political books are novels: Edward Abbey's The Fool's Progress, Elena Poniatowska's Tenissima, and Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed. These are all fictional books about political matters and revolutions in the 20th century and are written by activists. How can works of fiction, which have been systematically excluded from the philosophical canon, and which many complain are difficult to read, actually help inaugurate a new kind of philosophy, a minor philosophy, one that has a great deal to say about revolutionary movements, movements which always involve ordinary people and not paper blueprints?
I want to do a minor philosophy, just a minor threat, a minor philosophy about anarchism. What does it mean to philosophize about anarchism in a minor way? Taking something as ridiculous as some novels to talk about, and clearly, the kind of claim that you're making a very different kind of claim than somebody who is philosophizing using the canonical important figures. And in fact, at the last rat here, there was political fights, as there always are when the anarchist family gets together. And I remember very well this one person in the middle of a fierce debate about organizing, talking about my favorite anarchist, Malatesta. And immediately I thought to myself, he's egoizing. Now, if you read The Dispossessed, you know what that is, because in the anarchist society, the little kids get told, don't hit your brother. They get told, don't egoize, right? And if you know The Dispossessed, you know, in fact, that some of the people feel very ambiguous about this anarchist society that has been teaching little kids not to egoize. So this guy is going, my favorite anarchist, Malatesta, and I'm just going, man, you are egoizing so bad. I felt like you're not sharing Malatesta with me. You're trying to make me feel bad that I haven't read Malatesta, which I haven't, and I still haven't. So it's like you're not like sharing. You're not opening up. You're like making appeal to a major thinker in order to disempower other people, and that doesn't sound very anarchist for me. So then the question is, how can we get away from this kind of thinking? How can we get away from the major thinkers of political philosophy and begin to think through some anarchist ideas? So I just had the crazy idea for this session, well, what if we think about fiction? I mean, and no one can take this too serious. I mean, we're mostly going to talk about a science fiction novel, so it's obviously we're not taking this whole thing completely seriously. So maybe a way of thinking about ethics and activism and political change, a way of doing theory in a minor key, might be to reflect on some novels. Now, the organizers were dead keen that I not just talk about The Dispossessed, which is a very important novel for them. So they wanted me to talk about some other novels. And maybe, actually, when we get into it, if you have a political novel that you really love, maybe you could tell us about it and turn us onto it, and we'll all rush out and buy it or whatever. So I just want to briefly mention some other political novels that are actually kind of really important to me and I really like. The first one is by the Mexican writer Poniatowska. She has a very un-Mexican name because she's actually Russian. And the book is called Tenissima, which is a sort of fictional biography of Tina Moreri, who is lived in Mexico in the 1920s, and she was a very important photographer. She was going out with Weston for a while, and she did this like really, really beautiful art photography, which is what Weston taught her. And then she became a member of the Communist Party. And it's kind of really interesting, actually, because I actually read this when I was on Zapatista territory, which is kind of a freaking interesting experience. Because I bought it, because it's a Mexican book. You want to read a Mexican book in Mexico, And but the thing is, she's a member of the Communist Party. And all her life, she's doing what the Communist Party wants her to do, right? So that's what her politics is. So her personal ethics is an ethics of sacrifice. Like, she is sacrificing herself for the movement. And she obeys the party. She obeys the Communist Party. She goes where the Communist Party needs her. She goes to Spain, and she participates in the Spanish Civil War in a really heroic way. She works in Russia for a while, and then she goes back to She goes back to Mexico. And she even gives up her art for the revolution. Mm-hmm. Because when she goes to Germany in the 1930s, she's told, we don't want those beautiful artistic photography photographs. And, you know, we're in a position of crisis right now, and you have to do political photography. So she even gives up her art. She gives up her whole life for the movement. So that's kind of a really interesting novel to think through, and to kind of think through that kind of activism, and maybe what is the strengths and the weaknesses of that kind of activism. A second political novel, also about the 20th century, it's basically from the 1920s to 1975, is Edward Abbey, who of course wrote The Monkey Wrench Gang, which most people probably read, right? So I didn't want to do The Monkey Wrench Gang because that's too easy. But this is another Edward Abbey book that people probably haven't heard of, called The Fool's Progress, published in 1988. And it kind of summarizes Edward Abbey's entire writing in some way. It's got a bit of The Monkey Wrench Gang feel to it, but not in that kind of eco-porn kind of way. It's got his nature writing in it. And it basically tells the story of this guy who's born up on the East Coast of the United States, fairly poor farming family, and just tells the story of his family in the United States from the 1920s to the 1970s. And he's an anarchist in a certain way. He hates capitalism, he hates the state, and he doesn't want to work for capitalists, and he just spends his whole life avoiding work, and he works as a park ranger for most of the time. And he's also an extremely politically incorrect character, the main character in the novel, who's called Henry Hollyoake. He keeps having these passionate relationships with women, and that's kind of like what his life is. And the book is a series of flashbacks. He's driving home to see his family because he's found out that he's really seriously ill. And the whole book is a series of flashbacks. Between one chapter is the journey home in his truck that's gradually falling apart, with a dog that's also gradually dying, and flashbacks to the history of his family in the United States from the 20s to the 1970s. So he is an anarchist, but completely unlike Tina Moretti. He's not part of any political party. He's not sacrificing himself. He spends most of his life chasing women, to be perfectly honest. But he's an anarchist in a certain way, that he kind of stubbornly refuses to be part of the 20th century and stubbornly refuses to be part of capitalism in the 20th century. So I want to get to The Dispossessed, because I think that's what you've all come to talk about. But if you have your favorite political novel, I would just totally love to hear about it when we get there. So I'm assuming most people have read The Dispossessed or roughly know what it's about, but I'm going to assume that you haven't read it recently and you need your mind to be jogged just a little bit so we can get a discussion going about it. It is probably my favorite book of all time. I buy beat up copies in bookstores for $2 and I give them to kids. But also somebody was saying that Ursula Le Guin has written a critique of it or a commentary on it, so I'd be really interested to hear about that because I haven't read that. So I was going to just sort of very quickly remind you of the story and some of the characters, and I put them up here so we can remember the names of people and stuff like that. And then just kind of say why it's a really important book for me, and then I'm just like totally interested to hear what you think about it and your criticisms of it and why it's important for you or the bits you like the best or whatever. So you can just be a Dispossessed fan club for an hour or something. Hopefully it'll be fun. I think it's a very beautiful book, written and crafted. If you look at the structure of the book, it's like perfectly balanced. It's like a myth. And in fact, Ursula Le Guin's parents were both anthropologists, and there's a lot of influence from anthropological writing here. The anarchist society that she describes actually draws a lot on anthropological writings of pre-industrial and societies. So it's a beautifully structured book. So basically, the story is there's the Earth, which looks... the story alternates each chapter between two different worlds, or between a world and its moon. Uras, which is the Earth, is very like our world in the 1970s. It's got a capitalist state, it's got an authoritarian socialist state, and an impoverished third world state called Ben Billy. The main difference between Uras and our world is because this is set in the future. It's science fiction, after all. And capitalism has become more responsible. So private automobiles are very few, and they're very heavily taxed. There's a more ecological use of resources. And also there are some interesting differences that rich people on Uras dress in a much more extravagant way. Men don't wear dull business suits. They dress in very extravagant colors and clothing and cloth and so forth. Women go bare-breasted and wear very elaborate gowns on social occasions. But the cost of this life of the elite in the capitalist state is still borne by ordinary people, by workers at the bottom of the society. So that hasn't changed. And then there's the moon. And the idea is that there's supposed to have been an anarchist movement 170 years before the novel starts. And the anarchist movement got big enough to be a real pesky nuisance on this world, but not big enough to win a revolution. And that's really interesting. I want to come back to that. And so a deal is done so the anarchists can get the moon. But the moon is this really tough place to live. It doesn't have a lot of gravity, and the air is a bit thin, and it's not very fertile at all. Mm. So something, I don't know, 2 or 4 million, I've forgotten, anarchists are shuttled over in like the moon shuttle, you know, and they set up their anarchist world, and then the congress between the two worlds is closed, except that the anarchist moon anarchists has very valuable minerals, which are mined and sent back 8 times a year on a freighter to the world. So there's a kind of a first world, third world relationship between the earth and the brave anarchists trying to make their world on their harsh moon. The world that she describes is fascinating for us as anarchists. Like, I don't know if you've heard of Bolo Bolo, that book by PM. Well, if you check it out, it's a skinny little autonomy media book. It's called Bolo Bolo. I ignored it for years because I thought the title was really stupid. But it's actually a really cool book. It describes in this kind of science fiction way how an anarchist society might work, and it's totally inspiring. So have a look for it. It's by the author. It's just called PM, and the book is called Bolo Bolo, B-O-L-O-B-O-L-O. So similarly, in The Dispossessed, we just get this totally inspiring, you know, whenever you're depressed and things are not going well with the movement, totally inspiring picture of what the world could be. And it just makes so much sense to me and probably to you. There's no money, housing is freely available, people eat in collective cafeterias, clothing and tools are free. You just go to a depository and get what you want. So you want to play a guitar, you go to the depository and you get a guitar. When you're tired of playing the guitar, you bring it back. You know, get something else, whatever. People are not required to work. And this is really interesting because the anarchist society has a lot of individual freedom built into it. Though evading work is a recognized choice, right? These are the people called the Nuchnibi. And this is a recognized choice in the anarchist society, that if you want to, you can opt out and not accept work postings. And work is for 5 to 7 hours a day. And, of course, they don't have 7 days in the week. That's too, you know, on the seventh day, God rested and all that stuff. Their weeks go for 10 days, and you get 2 to 4 days off for every 10. Chores and maintenance work are shared on a rotational basis. For example, university professors every 10th day have to, you know, clean up the garbage and or do whatever. What in every collective I've ever been in is called shit work. You know, the stuff that nobody wants to do but has to get done. Yeah. There's no army, no police, no state. Personal relationships are very open. Teenage bisexuality is the norm. Friendships and sexual relationships are possible between men and men, women and women, or whatever. The biological family is not very important, and there are no family names. So if you want to be friends with your mother, you can, but you don't have to be. If you want to hang out with your dad, that's your choice, but maybe you might not. There might be somebody else in your life who would be really, really family. Nonetheless, as Joanna Russ points out, Le Guin does tend to favor long-term, stable, heterosexual relationships. The central character, if there is such a thing, is Shevik. And that's an interesting question for you when you read it. Do you identify with Shevik or not? Shevik is a difficult child. He's shy. He's alone. He's a good anarchist, but he doesn't fit very well in the society. And especially the anarchist society that after 170 years, it's a long time, has become to be somewhat rigid about the meaning of anarchism. right? So Shevik is a physicist. He wants to study physics. And his teachers don't want him to do the kind of physics he wants to do because it doesn't fit anarchist principles. And so they kind of block him going in the direction that he wants. So he finds that there's a kind of a wall put in the way of him developing the way he wants to develop. Also, some of his other friends experience similar restrictions when they try to exercise artistic or personal initiative. For example, Tirin writes an ironic play, and he's like personally destroyed when he's like publicly criticized for writing a play which goes against the principles of anarchism or whatever. And Bedap, who is also a friend, is a musician, and he can't get his musical compositions played because they go against anarchist principles of harmony and unity. His music sounds too harsh or discordant or something like that. So after 170 years, the anarchist society has started to become somewhat rigid, somewhat ossified. And that's the thing about, you know, the teachers telling the kids, don't egoize. You know, it's the exact same as in our society when kids are bossed around, except now they're being bossed to be anarchists. So this is kind of a really interesting thing. And also what I want to talk about in a moment is this long time scale in the novel, because I think that's really important. 170 years, 200 years. And the wall is a major symbol in the book. You know, the wall as a symbol of, you know, where something that stops you and you can't go any further. A wall could be a prison, or it could be, you know, someone that you're working with who won't let you make the music the way you want to make it. But everybody comes up against their wall, and then they have to discover, okay, how do you deal with the wall? And the way in which the book works is you don't knock down walls by charging at them full tilt, because you're going to hurt you. It's not going to work. You have to develop a strategy, which might be a sideways strategy for getting around or dealing with walls. So eventually, what happens is that Shevik and his friends form a new collective, which they call the Syndicate of Initiative. Right. So instead of being a syndicate to make shoes or to grow cucumbers or to make musical instruments or to make stained glass, their syndicate is going to specialize in producing initiative. Right? And they have the right to do this within the society, because within the society, it's an anarchist society. You cannot be told, don't start up a bakery collective. And similarly, you cannot be told, don't start up an initiative collective. But everybody hates what they're doing, and they're really unpopular, but they insist on their right to do that. So in a sense, what happens then is we have an anarchist revolution within the anarchist revolution, and then you know that Shevik then decides that strategically, if serious about breaking down walls, we're going to have to break down the wall between the anarchist moon and the Earth, and he goes in a spaceship back to the old world. As a famous physics professor, where he rediscovers the delight of this world, that, you know, human beings were evolved on this Earth over a very, very, very long period of time. Our bodies are attuned to this level of gravity and density of oxygen and all the rest of it. So he enjoys being back with the animals and the flowers and the birds and all the rest of it. But in the university, he's kept very much within another kind of walled thing. They're waiting for him to do some very important physics work that will have implications for long-distance communication in instantaneous long-distance communication. So eventually, Shevik realizes that he's in fact surrounded by another wall, and he breaks out of it and kind of goes underground in the old world and connects with an underground anarchist movement that's been kind of bubbling there underneath the surface. And then the novel just comes to an absolutely fabulous climax, where there's this huge demonstration in the street and helicopters clattering above, and we're all familiar with that, and police with billy clubs, and people get killed and so forth. And we never find out by the end of the novel whether Shevik going back to the old world in fact is the catalyst that is needed to make it the anarchist revolution complete. And Le Guin leaves that for us to answer. So that's kind of basically the story. So I'll just say what for me is important about it, and why I love this book, and then we'll just totally throw it open in we can have a First Love the Gun fan club in session. We could talk about some of the other books if you'd like to, and also your book. Okay. For me, one of the thing about The Dispossessed as a novel is that it has the influence of two major thinkers in it. One is Kropotkin, the Russian anarchist, lived mainly in the 1800s, and the other is the influence of the Tao, a Chinese philosophy from about 300 years BC. And the Tao, Kropotkin, of course, is the person who believed in collectives and communities and small-scale living, and thought that even in 1860 or 1870, enough goods were being produced on the planet Earth for everybody to have a decent life. It's just the class structure that means that some people get lots of goodies and other people don't get enough to eat. Lao Tzu, the Tao also recommends a more simpler pre-industrial way of life. Obviously, it was written 300 BC. But I think the influence of the Tao in The Dispossessed is not just, you know, that ideal of small community living that you also found in Kropotkin. I think also, and the Tao has this notion that you live in community, if you live in a community, maybe 3,000 people is enough. Yeah, and your community should be far enough from the next bunch of 3,000 that you really don't have to hang out with them unless you want to, right? So, but I don't think that's there. I think the really significant influence of the Tao is a Tao of revolution, right? In other words, what Le Guin is saying here is that the path to the revolution is probably not going to be linear, right? That we need to think about it in a more complicated way, in a Taoist way. So we start to think about a revolution as a flow that we can't control or that we can't direct it. And there are several reasons for this, but one of the most important is that the revolution is presumably going to happen over several generations, and which means that the people who start the revolution are not going to get to see the end of it. Right, so that makes a difference then if you start, because I think when you get involved, we get involved in anarchism or in activism first, and we get really enthusiastic about these ideas, which just seem to make so much sense to us, and we assume in 3 to 5 years we'll make the revolution, you know, and to think about it, like, what if I said to you, look, I'm a super duper heavy duty social political scientist, muckety muck muck, and I agree with you people, we will have an anarchist revolution. Capitalism is an unstable and destructive form of life. It can't go on. And you anarchists are absolutely right. And yes, politically it will happen in about 200 years. Now, seriously think about that. That's what I think the book is trying to say to us, to have this kind of a Taoist relationship to the revolution, that the revolution is this flow that you are a part of, but you are not going to be in charge of it. By comparison, Lenin, for example, that was, you know, back in the 1910s, 1920s, people assumed that the revolution was just around the corner, next year or 3 years, and Lenin sure as hell wanted to be there controlling it, right? Absolutely. So I think what Le Guin is saying for us is that we are part of this movement, we are part of this process, we are part of this flow, but it is something that is much larger than us, and none of us can control it. And actually, it's a damn good thing that none of us can control it. That would seem to be an elementary anarchist position, right? And in my personal opinion, as an activist, the people who want to control things and want to be in charge are the people who cause all the problems, right? So I really love this kind of Taoist notion that it is this flow, it is this long time period, it may be 7 or 8 generations, and the stuff that you're doing now is important and will have effects in 150 years, but you're probably not going to be around to see it. And you're actually not going to be around to see it. Yeah? If you've read other of Le Guin's work, you know there's a short story about Odo. The philosophy of the anarchists in The Dispossessed is called Odonians, after a woman philosopher called Odo. And Le Guin has a lovely, lovely story about her, which is published in the book called Wind's 12 Quarters, which is the last day of Odo. And she's living in his collective house, very like this. She's an elderly woman. She kind of dribbles a little bit. She's really wants to look as good as she can, but she knows that she's an elderly woman and her body is beginning to fail her. And you begin to realize as the story goes through that it's actually the day that she dies. And she is not going to see the revolution that she has worked for. Right? So that's like, woo. She's not going to see it. You know? She's been out there at the demonstration. She's been arrested. She's been in prison. She's just, and also she's a deep thinker, a philosopher, but she's not going to see it. You know, you think about that. So an anarchism that takes place over several generations obviously cannot be controlled by its founders, unless you create something like an authoritarian communist party and you have the body of Lenin embalmed in Red Square or something, and that's your way of, you know, controlling the future generations. But you can't control the future generations. They're the future generations. Right? You have to, or you can create a party apparatus with a central with a control function, which was, you know, beginning to develop in Anaris in the city of Albanais. Right? So this notion of the Tao of revolution, that what we are doing is deeply important, will influence and shape things to come, but we will not be able to control what comes. Right? So the thing that comes through for me, above all in The Dispossessed, is the personal modesty of the characters in the novel. Even at times when they're standing up really fiercely for things that they believe, there is a kind of quality of personal modesty about them, which I totally admire. And why the book is so wonderful is because it brings in this sense of the ethical and the spiritual and the everyday into anarchism. And those things, to me, seem to be really important. Great. So we can talk about anything. You can talk about your favorite novels and what they mean to you and how you think political philosophy through your favorite fiction, or we can talk about The Dispossessed and what you get from it and how you read it, and I'd love to hear all that.
I like your reading about the long-termness. That's something. I've read the book twice, once in the late 70s and once a few years ago. And yeah, it was something I never picked up on, so that's really neat. The two things that came to me from my reading of the book was an old saying from, I think it's from the United States War of Independence, the eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. I actually first learned it from hearing Barry Goldwater, a right-wing politician, ran for president against John Kennedy in the early 60s. Very right-wing politician. But it's an idea that I think is real true and has to be remembered. And I think it's very much dominant in The Dispossessed because the people let themselves become complacent. So they got this rigidity that Alan talked about, this structure. It became a non-revolutionary society. It had revolutionary form, but a sort of a counter form, but the people's thinking was not revolutionary anymore. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Alan missed in his summation of the book was when Shevik decided that he wanted to go back to Anaris, there were practically riots in the streets when he got on the rocket to go there. And I don't remember, did he come back? Wasn't that like at the very beginning of the book that he was actually coming back? Yes. I don't remember.
Are you going to tell people the story?
Oh, sorry.
He does come back. He does come back to the moon at the very end. The Hainish intervene, and we can talk about the Hainish later if you want. They're a very, very ancient people who make contact with the Earth from deep, deep space. He does actually go back to the anarchist moon with one person from the Hainish. So he does go back. Yes, you're right. The novel opens with Shevik walking very quietly, in his kind of modest but very firm way, to the spaceship, which has come to pick up the ore and the chemical, no, the minerals. And but on in the anarchist world, people are not used to. They don't quite know what to do, but they're very angry with them. And a rock is thrown, and actually somebody who's part of the defense group is actually killed by the rock, which is intended for Shevik, and he gets hit by it on the shoulder. Yeah, so that's interesting as well. Is the degree of we've all lived through big fights. These anarchists fight like crazy, and they're really mean sometimes. Like, so some of them there were willing to, you know, go to the airstrip and throw a rock and kill him when they just missed, which is worth thinking too. Because if he'd been hit, then the novel would stop, right? Yeah. But eternal vigilance, yeah, that 170 years on, they've become a little bit complacent. They've also had a famine, if you remember. There's a four-year famine called the Dust, where, you know, they've had to really tighten up just to get through this. But then the control mechanisms that were put in place during those 4 years are never then relaxed again. So it's always sort of other people.
Well, this is definitely one of my favorite books, The Dispossessed. So when I'm trying to think of another one, but this is really it. One of the things I took from it was the coercion to work. And I know that you mentioned the people who avoid work, but Shevik, there's a point where he doesn't want to work anymore, and he's questioning why he's doing it, and he feels this voice inside of him saying, you want to work, but he actually doesn't. So I think it's interesting going back to, I don't know if, going back to desire and whether it was a true desire that he wanted to work, or, you know, he's grappling with what he was told from his society and what he's actually feeling. So that was one thing. And then also just something that I loved the design of their society, the communal eating, the child raising, and the sharing of apartments, all of that was so interesting, and I love to see it actually happen. But one thing I couldn't get over was my own maternal instinct and not ever wanting to be able to let go of a kid that I had born. I couldn't see how I could do that. I know when they go to drop off their child, it's kind of this thing where they keep going back to visit and they're encouraged to visit less, and that I found really difficult, that I think I would be there every day, personally. So I don't know, I just wanted to throw those two things out there.
What do people think about those two things?
Yeah, there's I visited a community, Twin Oaks, before, and they actually experimented at one point with exactly that, trying to like rear the children as a community on the whole, and it never, I don't think, they never really got to fly, because the parents just wanted to look after their kids. I mean, I guess that another problem is that most people didn't stay there indefinitely, so at some point they left with their kids.
Mm-hmm. The children that were really happy with it either. I think there was a lot of it, the children. There was some homeschooling, but people were also going to public school. They felt the need to have, like, the same kind of, like, the shared experience as far as, like, role models and, like, authority figures go. So, like, having their parents was the closest thing they could get to a similar structure within that particular community.
I think on the motherhood thing, which is a really good issue to put out, is I think Le Guin is in some sense very open on that, because part of the reason, apparently, why Shevik is, you know, such a slightly odd person and doesn't fit in very well. He's kind of like an awkward kid, you know, kind of kids who often drift towards the punk scene and just, you know, maybe not great social skills and all that sort of stuff, you know, is actually because of the emergency, or because of the computer assigning people to different work assignments, his mother actually wasn't able to spend a lot of time with him in his formative years. Mm-hmm. So I think she maybe leaves that open as a question.
I think she leaves a lot open on both worlds for interpretation. I mean, she definitely does not paint in theirs as being this utopic society contrasted to this dystopic society back on the old world. I think that she does try to present a very complex picture of possibilities, but she doesn't frame them as such, that they're shut down, set in stone. It is very much up to both the individual reader and, you know, discussion groups to throw things out there.
Because Shevik is really surprised when he goes back to the old world. Because, you know, he's just being shown all these propaganda films when he's in school and stuff, to find that, you know, a lot of people are decent and
a lot of men treat women quite well, and the world is not falling apart in spite of the fact that it's organized in a hierarchical way. Yeah, so the old world is not all is not all bad at all. There's lots of beautiful things about it. But
I was going to comment on Chevek like meeting his mom later on. Mm. I feel like it was very cold, and like I don't remember it too well, but I feel like he was really cold to her and not very interested in continuing the relationship.
No, what was interesting too is after he saw her again, and then I think eventually, like they're separated again because he sees that what he has been longing for, because he has a strong relationship with his dad, but then her. He has no connection with his mom, and then when they are on the, I don't know, I don't remember how it's called, but the, you know, the trial thing, and his mom is, like, you have this character that you don't know till a certain point that it's his mom that is so drastically against him and Bedab.
Yes, in the forum where they discuss things, she becomes his worst enemy.
What exactly?
He overworks, which he does all the time. He totally pushes himself way beyond his limits. And he has a fever, and then he's brought to the infirmary, and then his mother has noticed that he's published a book of physics, and everybody in the society has a unique name, so she knows who it is, and so she comes to see him in the hospital. But you're right, he's very cold with her. She wants to restart this relationship, and he really rejects her. You know, he treats her as if she's a proprietarian. He rejects that relationship.
I actually observed the same thing about the relationship between Chevek and his mother. It's a gradually cooling off of it, and I really questioned this. I was like, I wonder why this is the case. And one clue I felt might have been offered is in the foreword. Not the foreword. It's in the I forget what you call it, but it's when you entitled Who's the Book For? It's for the partner, and that really changed how I started to read the book. It's really changed how I started to read, like, the different worlds and going back and forth between the worlds, exactly what kind of relationship was trying to be forged. Was it one of a parental dependence or something like that? Or was it more about one of fidelity and openness and the kind of responsibility which also comes with being faithful and responsible? And I am so impressed that Le Guin did not come down, you know, heavy-handedly with saying exactly what that kind of relationship would be, but presented so many opportunities to pause and think, like, in this scenario when you're sharing apartments, or in this scenario when you haven't seen the person in, you know, 2 or 4 years, what do you do in the interim? What do you do when you first see them again? Do you reconnect immediately? Is like, what if there's a child involved? All these important questions like were raised to me and made that one initial opening saying like so much more powerful as I went through the book. I don't know what you thought about that.
Takbar is Chevek's partner.
That's so right.
Don't they like keep their kid home for a few years because Chevek had that like negative experience, and it ends up being like really terrible for her as well. Like, it's really shunned that she's like not collectively raised or whatever. Like, I thought that was really interesting. Like,
the kid is treated really badly in school by the other kids, and perhaps even the teachers.
They're taking out their disapproval of the parents on the child, which presumably Le Guin disapproves of strongly. It just sounds completely unethical, crappy behavior to me. But I guess the kid is brought up at home then a bit. That she keeps that open, the ambiguity of whether Chevek is unforgiving and he should be more forgiving and be more open to this relationship that his mom wants to have with him later on, or whether the mother is, you know, really needy and is looking for what is in effect a dysfunctional relationship, and it's kind of there as a puzzle to think about. I'm just thinking this is probably the only session of this whole conference where motherhood has been talked about, but perhaps that's wrong. But I think this novel leads you into so many of those things.
The other thing that somebody raised that actually was used, the second thing, is work, which maybe we should we talk a little bit as well. You brought up some interesting ambiguities about that. I mean, the Marxist slogan is, if I can say it, what is it? From each according to their... ability to each according to their needs. So you, in the Marxist notion, you have to work to the best of your ability and you will be rewarded according to your need. That is not the case here. Yeah? Doing it. You said it. Like should it, should that...
Well, it sort of is the case, right? I mean, like, people don't have to work, but there's a lot of peer pressure, wasn't there? Like if you didn't work, you got... You were not a good ethical person or something like that.
Yeah. And didn't Tackworth kind of despise people who didn't like to do manual labor? Like Turin or one of the people, like, he wasn't into it. I mean, he was into doing other things, but not manual labor, like being out on the farms. And I thought that was really interesting. There was this people despised.
Well, and that's the interesting thing, that in this anarchist society, I mean, people do have different personalities and stuff. Yeah, and she feels very strongly about that because she's such a kind of a practical, hands-on kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
She's a research scientist, but she works in a laboratory developing strains of fish to improve food because there are no animals on the moon. Yeah, and she completely despises people who dodge their 10th-day
mm-hmm.
jobs or, you know, don't do their dishes in the language of collective houses. She's really strong about that. But Shevek at different points in the novel is very, very firm that in some sense the existence of the Nuchnibi is absolutely vital to the society. That, okay, you are disapproved of, but you are not going to be starved, and
mm-hmm.
you are
mm-hmm.
going to be allowed to live and survive. And in some sense, the people who refuse work postings, that Shevek is... He doesn't do that himself. We'll talk about that in a second. But Shevek thinks that it's very, very important for the anarchist society that,
mm-hmm.
that the anarchist society allows this
mm-hmm.
kind of deviance and, in fact, almost institutionalizes it in a sense. But then at different points in the book, there are places where the community exercises its will by extreme peer pressure on people, and sometimes that may be really uneasy.
Right.
You know? Like, if the community doesn't like you, I mean, you basically kind of get kicked out, you know?
Yeah, I can't quite remember now, but was part of it, did some people sort of have to go from one community to the next
yes.
because they kept sort of getting kicked
that's
out?
That's what these Nuchnibi would probably spend most of their life doing, because
yeah.
they're outsiders and loners, like Edward Abbey's character, and they don't work and contribute to society in the most obvious way. And, yeah, so they spend their life, you know, like some kids we know, moving from city to city and
mooching.
That's what they are, they're mooching. But for Spivak, for Shevek, their existence is absolutely vital because, in some sense, it's a guarantee that the wall of required work has not been closed. Maybe we should get to your question in a moment about why does Shevek always take on these work postings, including some very unsuitable ones for him and some ones that are very hard for him
mm-hmm.
Physically, even though he is at least to some extent critical of this whole system.
Yeah, I thought at a point that he was questioning the coercion enough to decide to become a Nuchnibi, and I don't know at what point you have to do that or if you can just say at any point, I am refusing to work from here on out. But I thought that was the vein it was going to go, and then no, he just kept on despite having to recognize the coercion. And I guess as someone who really does want to see some society like this function, even on a small scale, like you were saying, Twin Oaks, wanting work to be a joy, an expression of love, and never necessarily something that you're coerced into doing. So having this society where you don't have to work, and still this person feeling like he should, felt just, I don't know, contrary.
Doesn't it raise the question of what is work?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that, I mean, is playing the guitar work? Is making music work? I mean, in our society it is. In our society, some of the most highly paid people are entertainers, whether they're hockey players or you know, rock and roll stars. But in a way, you have to think about, is that work? Is that a contribution? How much is poetry worth in a society? How much are the things of the spirit? Because that's what our art is, things of the spirit, as opposed to things of the flesh, which is building a house and planting a garden. And I don't know, it seems to me that without spiritual sustenance, you live in a factory.
And the book is very strong on emphasizing exactly what you just said, because of these characters, one is a playwright, one is a musician, and Shevik is a dreamer of ideas. Mm-hmm. So that absolutely...
Although Shevik... I was just going to say, Shevik also, of course, the reason he is the other world is because he is, like, he's an Albert Einstein kind of character, right? I mean, he's, so that on that world, he's not really anything. They don't really care about this modern physics, but it's kind of interesting that, I thought, the whole...
Yeah, because what's lacking for these three characters is a recognition from their own society, so it's not about the worth of work. Yeah, I feel like what's missing, because yeah, you can do whatever you want, but then if the society you live in doesn't recognize you or your work and have no idea of the worth of your work, then it's also, you see also how it falls apart. And I think that's why he just renounce and submit himself to go, you know, during the dust, so far away, and because anyway, like, what's the meaning of if he can't share his work and all that. But I say just one more thing too, is that's why I think like her book is like the most fabulous anthropological work I've ever read, and like, I'm an anthropologist, and I think like it's so interesting. Like, I've never seen somebody explain how enculturation works and works so well, and you know, it's almost something unescapable, and I think that's why it was so disturbing to read the novel, because then what do you do when, even with our best values at work, once it's enculturated, you lose your freedom, which is at the core of, I think, my anarchism, or you know, like, and so that was. And there were big fights in the house, like, because, I don't know, we got completely different impressions of Anna Hesse. Like, I felt really sad and disappointed about, like, the possibilities of humanity, where you can bring it because of this enculturation and this, like, rigidity. Like, anything that gets institutionalized seems to want to die, and others, but still, like, Anna Hesse is still much better, and all the details that you've talked about, but then I like collective kitchen, blah blah blah, but then I sort of re-fell in love for this world, because I thought, well yeah, but we can have it in this world, I felt I was preferring having it inside this world than bringing it somewhere else.
I think to me it was kind of important, like, that they did have, like, peer pressure, and like, because it wasn't a utopic novel, and I mean, it was an ambiguous utopic novel. Like, some people would read it and they wouldn't like that world at all, I'm sure. I mean, so and it isn't obvious. Le Guin doesn't make it obvious how much she approves of that world, really. I mean, it's. I mean, I think that she has an approval to it, I think, but. But at the same time, it is very ambiguous utopia, which I thought, and it, I mean, I guess to me, I mean, things are going to be wrong, I think, even if we get our utopic future. I mean, it's not going to be, there's still going to be problems, so it's very interesting to consider what kind of personal problems will it be.
And very interesting to know that it is a very particular utopia. For example, if there are any primitivists here or green anarchy people, this is not the kind of utopia those people are arguing for at all. These people have elected to keep you know, medium level of technology. They're very interested in technology and stuff. So it's not really a utopia that everybody will buy into.
Along
there's, I was going to mention another book, actually, that I had read, called Woman on the Edge of Time. I don't know if other people have read it, but that's actually the society. You can imagine, I mean, the society is an anarchist society that is possible. It's at one in the future in this world, and I mean it takes place in Cape Cod. You know, you can picture the scenery, you can picture, you know, exactly what they're doing there, and it gives you the hope that you know, to be able to visualize it like that. It's great. And, yeah. You know, great for a whole bunch of other reasons too, but it's great.
Who wrote that before?
Oh, Mark Piercy.
I actually just wanted to pick up a point on what this woman raised and talk a bit about why in the story these people ended up being rejected, and also what the value of the work is. And I think Le Guin sort of touches on this in an indirect way through her analysis of how Chevek responds to being sick. He's extremely afraid of becoming sick. Why not? Because of the feeling of being sick or anything, but knowing, like, what it does to the entire group and the community, knowing how interdependent people are. If one person's sick, well, it's kind of the weakest link in the chain. And the other way, I think you can understand, at least for me, I began to understand the value of work is the way Le Guin, I think, very, very well spoke about Odo and the difficulty she had working in the discipline of science, which is traditionally a male-dominated science, and how Chevek actually took her as his role model. It was no other man, and he had the very same problems when he was working in the institute on NRS. And so using those two things, I think you get to see, again, indirectly, like his fears of being rejected from that institute. Why? Because he was taking a female as his role model and was trying in some strange way to adopt like these ways of going about business, going about doing work. So in a sense, to be rejected from an institute like the Physics Institute on NRS wouldn't necessarily be a slight against him. It would just be another notch in the kind of battle which was started by Odo and is now continuing through Chevek and will continue further on. It's consistent.
Mm-hmm.
He's a complex character, because in some ways he's deeply conformist, because as the person here was saying, he really has internalized these values, and you point out so well that when he's sick, he's so ashamed of being sick and can't accept medical treatment and all the rest of it. He is, in some sense, very conformist, but at the same time, there's another part of his personality where he's a total rebel.
Something I really liked in that book was in the beginning when he gets to Urus and he's given this room by himself and he's very comfortable being in this private setting, and then he kind of started to like it a lot, and eventually he's like, oh, we don't have that at home, and it's something we miss. So I thought that was very interesting, and that brought a lot of questions to mind.
Was this the broader point you're making
for privacy?
About acculturization, so Chevek becomes acculturated to the norms of the anarchist mood, and then when he moves and they give him this study at the university, he very quickly becomes acculturated and accustomed to that. Is that what you were talking about how malleable human beings are? When we move from one setting to another, we become so influenced by our surroundings or so used to what's new?
I was actually saying completely the opposite, but but I mean it works too. But what I mean is because and it's interesting when you were talking about like to the partner thing and how like partnership is so important. Yet like, and you know these two are really in love, really close together. But even then, like when she get posted with the baby, and then he has to choose, he still choose to go because it's the dust, and he has to do, you know, c'est quoi? The responsible thing for the community, and so I don't know. Like to me, it was more that you can't. Yeah, he's a rebel, but. It's like he can't really escape completely, like his enculturation of community above like individual. But then, because I think that, yes, of course, when you change, then the freshness of it and you know, because that the life on Arras is so luxurious compared to the world, and you know, everything is so luscious, and the animals and the forest and the clothes and the food, and so of course, like the first, it's like any one of us who, I feel like it's almost a class thing. It's like it's much easier to go up than to get accustomed to go down, but then I think he was still, like, you know, he still went back to Anaheim because he's still completely committed to.
And he was getting first row luxuries, of course. Like, he probably wouldn't have liked the third row nearly as much.
Mm. Or yes, and maybe he talks about it because he's at one point the representative from the socialist society. He says, you know, you're an anarchist, you should be with us.
Yeah.
What are you doing physics for the capitalists? And he says no. And also he doesn't go to the poor third world country, which is what you would expect him
to
do. It's only later on in a roundabout way that, you know, those connections begin to come.
Well, I guess that the first world maybe like they admired him the most. The third world, let's say, probably wasn't as interested. I'm not sure, but probably they weren't as interested in his
and Billy.
No, science and all that, which enjoyed the lure of being this genius that was rock stars or pop stars.
I don't think he enjoyed it at all. Actually,
no.
I think towards the end, I think he's disgusted with it.
Well, no, but isn't that? I mean, partly he was attracted because he was interested in
exchanging.
Oh yeah,
like,
no,
people
but,
that
like
his
the
ideas.
Love of the science and like he was completely caught up with like trying to understand time in another sense than linear.
And I mean, didn't he like that they supported him in that? I mean, that was an advantage.
He loved that he had people to talk to.
Right.
What is
yeah.
What's that?
Oh, I just said yes. That's it.
Because to develop ideas, he says you need people to talk to. And when he was young, with friends, you know, late at night, you know, they'd be daring each other to flights of fancy because one idea sets off another idea, like here.
Right.
See how it works. You know, you need 8 or 10 people, and then we start setting each other off, and that's how it developed. So he had nobody who he could talk to about his work.
Yeah, it seems like he really detested the celebrity status he got on Arras, because, like, I've only read like the first 75 pages or so, but I remember he comes into the city and the media makes up all these stories. Like, I don't remember anything in particular, but
they invented a little speech of welcome that he
supposedly
said, but he in fact didn't say it.
Media, what was
it? You know, he disliked he mostly disliked the media attention, but he certainly enjoyed the opportunity to talk to people about his work, which maybe is another one of his deep conformity. This guy's really into his work, eh?
But he enjoyed it, but then too is ambiguous, because then he discovers that even the two closest person that he can talk about his works, they have completely different goals with it. So then, like, if you don't have, even if you work on the same, like if your finality is not the same, like that means it's going to change your ontology and it's going to change everything, and that's why, like, then after that it's irrelevant.
It's what?
But it's finally, like, it's not so fruitful. That the dialogue
right.
that you wish so much, then it's just like falls apart if you don't share. Like,
I'm not sure that you're right. That his liking to talk about his work is like part of a conformity thing. It's like coming here. I mean, I regard, you know, doing politics, radical politics, as my work. I do a job that's different, but this is my work, and I like coming here. And if it's something that moves you, something that excites you, it's like you wouldn't say that about a guitarist who sat down with another guitarist and exchanged licks. So he just likes to talk about physics because that's what he likes doing.
So it's pleasure as well as
and
all the other complicated things, sense of, you know.
I actually would just like to echo that. I think towards the end, even in the most dire circumstances, when the city is under siege and there's this huge protest and people are dying in his arms, he's got blood all over him, it's precisely that same sort of desire and motivation which pushed him to study, you know, physics and metaphysics, right? Which has led him out to realize, like, no, like, what is just as important and what he's been working on all along, it's really the same question, can now be expressed in a different kind of language. And so there's the joy of, like, learning this new language, which happens to be a language of the of the Banbili. And so to me, it's really very much of a whole. It's not so much, well, first you do this, then you kind of fall out of love with it, and then you pick something else up. It's really just pursuing the same question in different environments.
Do we want to move a little bit into talking about when the novel gets into the revolution and how that came about, and are there any conclusions we can take from our own? We've been talking mostly about the early part of the novel a lot, and about Shevet as a person, and his motivations, and the anarchist society. I haven't heard anybody say there were things there they didn't like.
Except for peer pressure.
Would you want to eat cafeteria food for the rest of your life? I have no problem with that, but maybe you could.
If it's this cafeteria, I don't. But, yeah.
Please?
Oh, DivLab. The computer, it seemed really bureaucratic, and, but I mean really efficient at the same time, which is like an interesting take on like technology, like using it to benefit society, and but at the same time it's just like I mean I really felt like it was bureaucratic, and the professor guy that's like Chevek's
kind of,
yeah, like I mean doesn't he like don't they use DivLab to kind of exile people to the other side of the planet, basically, like to get rid of them, like a couple of Chevek's friends.
Can you explain that a little more? I don't remember.
DivLab is the computer, and you go and you sign up for a work posting, which generally is not for life. Like for example, a 3-month posting in a mine, and a 3-month posting on a farm, and a 3-month posting, and so it's a computer. So they're not primitivists, and they're very proud of their computers. This is 1970.
And it's centralized.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's centralized. So we're talking mainframe here, and. And yes, it does seem that it's not just simply a rational, efficient way of allocating people where they're needed, but it does seem that it is being manipulated, we're not quite sure by who or how, to send, quote, troublesome people to unpleasant places. And
officially it's random, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And also there's a woman here who complains that this is wrong, that the computer is breaking up mothers and children and partners, and we should override the computer and just keep the partners together.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was something that, yeah, again, I keep coming back to the partnership. Like, Chevek had such a desire to be with this woman, or it seemed that, you know, they had this bond and he didn't seem to have too many other bonds. So I was surprised that... in 100 so many years they hadn't figured out how to keep partnerships together. You know, and not that I want, you know, necessarily the new society to adhere to, you know, the heterosexist norms that we have today, because I liked the sexual freedom in the novel.
Well,
but I did think it was really sad that they were apart for so long. And I was actually going to comment on something else, which was the time when the professor was writing his name to submit work, like he was writing his name on stuff to submit work. I was like, that's so wrong. How is that getting just accepted? And I guess it wasn't necessarily, but it was happening, and how much of that was happening.
So what was that situation?
He was writing stuff, and it wasn't getting passed, I guess.
I think his name is Sabu, is it?
Mm-hmm.
I forget the names.
The professor... physics,
and
he's taking credit for Chevek's work.
Okay.
He's also rewriting it and messing it up. And but Chevek's warned about this by his high school physics teacher that you know, you're leaving this small town here. You're going to go to New York. You know, things are tough in New York. They play dominance games in New York. So his high school warns him. You know that the city of Abenay is a is not like this small town. You know, people play political games like that, and you're going to have to learn how to play those games. So, but do we want to talk a little bit about? Is there anyone else want to jump in about the? Yeah, please.
Well, I just like to was this changes the topic a little. So, I'm not, but anyway, I was just wondering about. I can't quite remember how they dealt with criminals, but they she addressed that, didn't she? Like murderers and so on.
That's very, very important, because the society that doesn't have police, doesn't have army, and doesn't have prisons. But there is an island, I think it's the island of Segovia or something like that, where people are sent for to be helped, right? Sort of like rehabilitation or to be helped.
Mm-hmm.
One of his friends, I think a playwright, is sent there because he has like a crisis or what some people call nervous breakdown, and he's sent there presuming to be helped get back on his feet. But it turns out that this therapeutic community, in fact, has become a little bit like a prison too. So this anarchist utopia has slipped quite a bit, many different fronts when we look at it. The apparently inhumane way the partners are not kept together, the dominance games that are going on in the capital city, the abuse of the computer to punish people.
It doesn't talk about like juries or whatever, like any sort of judicial system, does it, in the book?
No, that's a good question. And a lot of the stuff in here seems like you're judged by your peers, which in some sense is good. Being judged by your peers is generally a good thing. But, you know, people can also be scapegoated.
Yeah.
And there doesn't seem any protection against that. So your only protection really is just to leave the collective and go somewhere else.
Well, so it's more ostracism that serves as a control of society, which perhaps she took from her. But what you're just saying so almost makes me doubt about... I think the most beautiful passage in the book is when he gets so mad and so angry in the party, like, when he's Arras, yeah, and he's with this woman who's just like, yeah. And then, I don't know, I think it's just and then you come to know why it's called the Disposes, and, you know, he said, yeah, you have everything and we have nothing but each other, you know, you have all these jewels, but we have only each other's eyes and but all the things that you have possess you, so you are the possessed and we are the dispossessed. Mm. And I just think it's beautiful.
It's a hard thing to think through if you'll be that comfortable with, you know, just having, you know, some very basic personal goods which are yours just to use.
That seems very Taoist, doesn't it? That idea.
To feel comfortable to go through the world that lightly. You know,
I think
probably even without your tenure that you had when you were three. But maybe you could. Please.
Oh, yeah, just like that was like in a reading circle, anarchist reading circle I was in, like that was a theme we talked about in the Dispossessed, was like the scarcity issue and how that actually builds bonds with other people rather than this abundance and just everything is around you, and you know, like the hardship that you have to endure like really does, you know, give us bonds to hold on to each other, I guess. And that was something that we were, that was interesting.
Because this moon that they're giving is that there's this huge amount of scarcity. It's very, very difficult. That just making me think that Jean-Paul Sartre, actually, in his philosophy of how human beings bond, assumes that there is a fundamental scarcity of goods in the world. In how he thinks through different kinds of bonding, assumes there is a fundamental scarcity, which is the complete opposite of Kropotkin. Because Kropotkin's basic assumption is, in fact, there are enough basic goods for us all to have an enjoyable life. It's just the capitalism and social class is just deeply irrational.
Well, and just to actually give a counterpoint to that, though, like, there's that one point where Chevek's in that train for a few weeks and they're starving to death and they're about ready to invade the town and take the food themselves, and like it takes such like social restraint for them to like not do that. And I thought that was a really good contrast.
I think the town almost gets out the shotguns because they're not taking our food.
Right.
Remember that? They're stuck there for a couple of days in the train and they haven't eaten, and there's a small town there, and the small town only has a very small amount of, it's exactly what you're saying, this fundamental scarcity on this world. And I think there's almost a kind of vigilante thing that comes out from the little towns, like that if this train, you know, ate all food, that then we would starve.
Mm-hmm.
So they got to stay on their train and tighten their belts for 3 or 4 days. Yes.
Yeah, so I did, I mean, that was an interesting point, I guess, that I thought about when I read the book, was like, if the moon hadn't been so scarce, like, would it have actually... Would that have been that bonus for them, or would that have made the whole thing not work? And I guess it's completely open.
It would have been much less interesting novel.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
if you put it in an ideal situation like California, lush, it'd be too ideal, it'd be too easy.
Yeah, but it might be that somehow the same bonds wouldn't form, or like there was at least some evidence in the novel that it was the difficulty with kind of bonded the people together. So maybe you couldn't have had that anarchist utopia if it had. But I don't know. She didn't make that clear because there wasn't a third moon that was.
Perhaps you could try to hear.
Oh yeah, there was something else I want to say, but coming off of that, that kind of makes me think of how creative the anarchist scene is with making use of the stuff that nobody else wants, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, they wouldn't be able, the capitalist world wouldn't have this, lush place to sit around. They would let a new society form. And so there's, the whole side of that. I really like the way that she does dance around the peer pressure and with the idea of the status quo and how, people know how much work has to be done, right? Like, everybody gets, that they have to contribute. And they do recognize, sometimes you just don't want to work. So I like that it's recognized, and then the way that it's sort of enforced that everybody needs to work is that they have the internal thing, and then they have the external, harsh gaze. It's not like a,
What time is it?
It's 25 to 6. Do we go to 4:45?
6, I think.
There's some people who want to say something. 6.
So.
She just thought I should talk since I haven't talked to him. But,
yeah.
I mean, there's a few things. I really liked how she wrote the book, how slow moving, and how it was sort of like an everyday time. I mean, I tried to give someone the book to read and was really upset when they said, oh, it's too slow moving, because I felt they were looking for one of these science fiction cheap thrills, oh, this new world and this happened and this exploded. And I really liked how she just went every day, and it was just very slow, and you could get into his pattern of everyday life, I mean, in a certain sense. And also, I also read another book of hers, Left Hand of Darkness. I don't know if anyone's ever read.
Mm-hmm.
I love that book as well. It deals a lot with gender, sex, identity, power.
Mm.
So I would definitely recommend that. It doesn't really, not so much anarchism, but just a whole sense of another man's journey. And it's a really good book. So.
Yeah, it's this hypothetical situation where people have a neutral gender.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of like a cat, you go into heat. And you never know before you go into, I think it's called Kemmer.
Yes.
Whether you're going to be a boy or a girl, your sexual organs develop differently. Can go either way. You never know. Which means that everybody in society can potentially become pregnant. Because you're just this neutral gender, and I'm getting my... And it's recognized in the society where you actually get, I think, a week off work because you're going to be so super sexed.
Yeah, you that you can't function or you can't. Yeah.
And people can tell from other people who glow faces and stuff that they're just dying to find somebody to have mad passionate sex with for a week or so. And then there's this incredible journey where people go through the wilderness.
Oh.
Isn't that a novel? It's a big, huge, long wilderness.
Yeah, it's really long through the ice.
Also very slow.
Yeah.
I found sometimes, trying to turn people onto this, some people find it difficult to get into the beginning.
Yeah.
They say it's really slow, it's hard to read, but then if you give it a little bit, then you...
Yeah, it's like an adventure. It's not just a...
Somebody else wanted to say something?
Quick.
Well, I might switch gears a little bit, but it's another book that I thought maybe... I'd like to know how you guys thought about it. If you read it, Ecotopia. Maybe you've read it. Who wrote that? Ernest Kallenbach. Or, I don't know how to pronounce it. And, well, I read it, a short while ago, so I don't remember the whole thing, but that was kind of... very good idea of what a utopic society could be, but there was still government, and it was still very they were basically in place forever, and but they had the whole decentralized and very sustainable way of doing things. Have you read it at all?
Sounds great.
Check
it out.
He talks about some really interesting stuff that I've never seen in any other utopias, where they have the ideas of the wars in there.
Mm-hmm.
Like the necessity for battles.
Hand-to-hand combat. They're not about killing each other, but it's about that whole,
getting it out.
There's a whole bunch of things where he brings up contradictions that would, not necessarily their innate tendencies, but they'll most likely exist in some kind of form. And, you know, it's a pretty hokey book in some senses, but it's neat that he, you know, tries to dance around it. Sounds great.
Yes. The last book I read before I started The Dispossessed was The Fifth Sacred Thing by Starhawk. That's another great book, but it's very interesting just how they're written in almost opposite writing styles. There it's just like, this is happening, this is how utopia is going to work, and in The Dispossessed it's more of like, this is a possibility, it's day by day, it's more slow moving.
The Starhawk is not a novel, it's her usual style.
No, it's a novel.
It's a novel. Amazing. I didn't know
it
was a novel.
Yeah.
Is it called again?
The Fifth Sacred Thing.
I should look for it.
Yeah. It's quite brilliant.
I've read some other books which are, you know, kind of really interesting the way they're put together.
It's the same idea, two societies, you know, one's the anarchist society and the other's this fascist, consumerist state.
Next year we should have a...
On the heels of that, I just want to warn everybody to skip the sequel to The Fifth Sacred Thing, Walking in Mercury. Because, you know, The Fifth Sacred Thing is really juicy in terms of, like, the Bay Area politics just exemplified in terms of a utopian vision contrasted with the worst of Southern California. You know, all of that. And, yeah, her sequel just doesn't get into the juicy stuff like that at all.
Definitely check that out. I also like Star Wars writing. I know one thing about our discussion that we very much talk about, you know, Shevek and the people and the society and the co-ops and the collectives and their working and that side of it, but no one has wanted to talk about making a revolution, and that is part of the book as well. Mm-hmm. So the notion in the book is not only is that this world, which is like Earth, is in some sense an unstable and destructive system, and something needs to happen. But this temporary anarchist world is also in its own way unstable and in the long run unsustainable. And so in this longer flow of time, longer than any single lifetime, something's going to happen. And how that works out in the novel is in this indirect way we've been talking about, the kind of the vow of revolution. It's not like Lenin and his buddies got together like in a room like this and planned how to seize state power in Russia. How this happens over a long period of time is indirect with some element of accident and whatever. But the novel, The Dispossessed, as you know, just comes this incredible climax where there is actually a big demonstration is called. There's a war going on, which sounds very like the war that's going on right now. Where big issues are being fought out in small countries that, rather than the United States, well, you have a little bit of that. But it does come. So there is a revolution. There are people in the streets. There are people who are killed in the streets. There are police. There are helicopters, and this does seem to be part of the novel.